Good morning. I'm sure if you're like I am, you're just about seminared out by now. I can imagine when you stand up, it can feel like you're wearing those chairs. Well, you know, the topic is From Passion to Purpose. And it's interesting to me because when Jonas asked me to talk about this, I wondered if I was really the person that ought to be talking about passion to purpose. I've always been someone that tends to err on the side of passion, I think. I find myself living hard. I always tell my students, if you're going to be in my class, you're going to have to find a way to do hard living. Sometimes we would go out to play King's Base on a really cold day, you know, and some of them wouldn't be into the game. And I would always tell them, you better get into the game soon or I'm going to circle your base and you're going to have lost before we started. So I believe in hard living, and I've often erred on the side of that kind of passion. So it's interesting for me to find myself giving a talk on passion to purpose. You know, sometimes passion has actually gotten me into trouble. I remember once, a few years ago, I was doing a science experiment with some of my students. And we were having a little contest to see who could build a machine that would launch an egg the farthest distance. The one group was a group of girls, and they had built this massive slingshot that you would actually connect to two trees and big, big stretchy rubber bands. And it had a little cup that had foam on the inside so the egg wouldn't break when it launched. And they had this thing built, and they were preparing to launch it for the first time. But they were afraid to launch it. And me being a person that believes in living hard, I thought, well, you know, I'll show you all how to launch that egg. So I sauntered up and offered to shoot the first egg for them. And I thought, you know, if I'm gonna shoot this thing, it is gonna be the farthest shot this thing ever makes. So I grabbed that bungee cord with the egg in it, and I pulled that thing back just as far as I could possibly pull it back. And I'll have to go. And I don't know if you've ever been in any of these situations, but sometimes you know something really bad is about to happen and you can't stop it. That's how this was. The cup took the egg out, and then to my incredible horror, it didn't shoot the egg. It actually turned around and shot the egg straight back and hit me square in the chest. An example of where passion has gotten me into trouble sometimes. So I find myself intrigued that I'm here talking about passion to purpose, and how does passion and purpose really come together? And that's what I'd like to talk about today. There are a couple of assumptions that I think we need to get out there before we get into the talk. You know, it's always difficult to see both sides of every coin in the moment. So if we get those out of the way ahead of time, we don't need to be thinking about that throughout the whole talk. So a few assumptions that you should be aware of. First of all, there are times for teachers to quit. I'm not going to talk about those much today. And sometimes I'm not sure what they really are, but I'm convinced there are times for teachers to quit. Another assumption you need to understand is that I believe that Christian education is at a crisis point. I believe the next 10 years are going to be telling years for Christian educators. Years that will either make or break us. I don't know if you've noticed, but even here at Teachers Week, this very weekend, we have a bit of a logistical problem. Bless all you ladies' souls, but I do wish there was more men here. I know many of you may not believe this, but take it from me. Many, 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 many of you will get married sometime. There is such a thing as sustainability. And as Christian educators, we do need to think about that. And we need men in our schools that are going to be teaching for year after year. 10 years, 15 years. So while it's great that all of you ladies are here, my heart bleeds and wishes to see more men that are committing their lives to long-term time in the classroom and service to their communities. So we have our own logistical problems. It all boils down to the fact that I think in the next 10 years, we will know whether what we're doing is actually sustainable, whether it's something that can't continue for year after year. I'd like to do two things today. I'd like to briefly talk about why teachers quit, and secondly, talk about a different kind of teacher. I'm not going to spend very much time on the first point, mostly because I don't really feel qualified to talk about it. Secondly, I'm not always sure how helpful it is for us as teachers to talk about why teachers quit when many times it's connected to broader things than ourselves. If there's anything that possibly qualifies this past year in my mind, the thing that I will remember this year by, it seems like it's the year Kyle's friends stopped teaching. I had many friends quit teaching this summer, and many of them for good reasons. One of the things I did decide to do was to just ask a lot of questions and do some research and try to find out what it is that draws people away from the classroom. And I came up with three things. I'm sure they're not the only things, but there are three themes that seem to come through in many of the people that I talk to. First of all, I think people quit teaching at least sometimes because of relational stress. And this comes in different forms. The kind of relational stress that I'm thinking of is relational stress in relation to your community and the people that actually make your community who it is. So first of all, I think a lot of teachers quit teaching because their relationship with their students is put under duress. A lot of times we have a lot of hopes and aspirations for our students, some of them being finishing school, who knows what they may be. And when our students disappoint us, we feel like quitting. It's not uncommon. I've felt this many times. Another place where we sometimes feel relational duress as teachers is in our parental relationships. It is stressful. It's difficult. It's hard to go to school every day knowing that you have a parent that is not completely behind you or that you're not really getting along with. So sometimes parental relationships can stress us out and make us feel like quitting. And finally, another possibility is relational stress in connection to your community. Who you are in relation to your community. How your community sees you. These things, they're just stressful. They're hard. We are inherently relational people. And when those relationships come under duress, we can often feel like quitting.
The second reason that a lot of people get out of teaching is financial reasons. And I really just don't have much to say about this. It's difficult. Especially if you have a family, I think. The only thing I have to say is people do it. Jonas has taught for 40 years somehow. People do it. It's possible. If you weren't teachers, maybe we would talk about paying teachers more, but it doesn't make sense to talk to you about paying teachers more. So all I can say is it's possible. It can be done. There are people that do it. And the third reason that I often come upon that teachers quit teaching schools, I think they start the wrong way. I don't know if you ever thought about this, but what if our preachers acted like our teachers? Well, I'm going to preach. I'll be in the ministry for 3 years. And then it's getting hard. I'm going to leave the ministry. And there people do, and there are times to leave the ministry. But our preachers, thank God, don't act like our teachers. Our churches would be in a predicament. One thing is, I think our preachers start in a different way than what we often think of starting into teaching, beginning years of teaching. We call our preachers out of our communities. We say we have nominations, depending what congregation you're from. You have an ordination then. And you look at your community and you say, who is the person we want to lead our community? And then we do what we got to do to put them into that position. And of course, we invite God to be part of that decision as well. But we don't approach teachers that way. There aren't very many communities that look at their community and say, who is the young man or woman in my community that I want discipling our young people? And then we're going to go and do whatever we got to do to get that young man or woman to come teach in our community for a long time, because they're the person we want doing that. We take a different approach to teachers. I have a vision for sometime seeing our teachers actually take a greater sense of ownership for your own community. And obviously our communities have to do this as well. But a kind of ownership that says, this is my community. They want me to teach because they think I'm the person that they want their young people to become like. That's what discipleship essentially is. It's the model that I think Jesus offers to us, so we disciple those around us. And I have hoped that someday our communities actually will look at teachers more that way. And I think that's possibly more sustainable. Now, if in that model, right, in that kind of a model, I do think we need a different kind of teacher. And that's where I'd like to share the five paradigm shifts with you. The first paradigm shift that I would like to share with you is the paradigm shift from making a difference to being faithful. Okay, so in this model of the community looking among their young people and saying, that's the person I want my child to become like, so I want that person in my school discipling my child. In that model, you have to be the kind of person that can be faithful to your community then. They can respond to that desire, that call that says, hey, we want you to be our teacher. It takes a kind of faithfulness to respond to that kind of a call. Lots of times I ask teachers, why do you teach? Well, yeah, I just want to make a difference in somebody. I want to make a difference. That's noble and that's honorable. I do think you run the risk. If that is the primary reason you teach, I think you run the risk of burning out. Primarily because if you're all about making a difference, that is based completely on measuring other people's performance. So if my goal, if the way I completely measure my talk with you this morning here, if I measure it completely on the basis of how I change you at the end of this day, chances are I can't even measure that, because I don't know what goes on inside of you completely, and some things aren't the way they look. And if you're like me at all, I look at my students sometimes and I think, you know, am I actually doing anything? Am I pulling anything off that's worth anything? And normally when I actually sit down and think about it, it's probably true there's a lot more going on than what I can see. But when I measure myself on that basis, I get discouraged. And so I think teaching first to make a difference is the prime way to burn out. I don't think it's really sustainable. It's too hard to control. On the other hand, shifting to the purpose of being faithful measures yourself. Say, am I being faithful? And in this model that I'm sharing with you, I think it's very possible to be faithful. When your community comes to you and says, we think you're the person that we want our children to be like, I think you can be faithful, and you can measure that. You can decide if you're actually doing this. So I think it's a very possible thing to do, this idea of being faithful. And we know the stories. You read the stories in the Bible. Moses, Joseph. If these guys lived to make a difference, all right, and we know they did, but that's when you read the end of the story. You put yourself in their life sometime in the middle of their story and think about how much it would feel like you're making a difference. And we know that these are men of faith. So I think we need to shift from being teachers that are about making a difference, even though that's important, to being teachers that are about being faithful. The second paradigm shift that I would like to share with you is from doing teaching to being a teacher. I've often really struggled. This is something that that I've believed for, I don't know, quite a while. And sometimes my friends try to get me to explain this, and I have trouble explaining it. I'm going to give it my best shot. One of the ways I think that I can best understand it is by using an analogy that I actually know something about. One of the things that I do as a hobby is I got into distance running when I was in high school. And me and my older brother have continued doing this together for the last 10 years. And believe it or not, we now, sometimes I drag this old carcass across the distance of a marathon. And I don't really, it's one of those things that, to me, I understand it. Until you've been at mile 20, it's a little hard to explain what that's like, but I'm going to give it a try, all right? It's one of those things where you run and you run and you run and you run, and then you start to hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt, and then you start to find that you hurt in places that you didn't know you had places, and you still have a long way to go. And so my brother and I, we've studied this running thing and said, there's got to be an easier way to do this. It shouldn't hurt that bad to run that distance. There's got to be a way. Other people do this fast, and it looks easy. To make matters worse, the first marathon we tried, we weren't very wise about choosing it. So we picked this marathon that the first 17 miles is a steady uphill climb. And then mile 15 to 17, I think, is literally, it's like right up the side of a mountain. And then you finish the marathon going down the other side of the mountain. Well, we weren't smart enough to know that you should probably start in a marathon that's more flat if you've never ran that far before. Some of the first marathon that I ran was this incredibly difficult one. In fact, later we found out it's in the top 10 most difficult marathons in the United States. It's an example of a lack of internet research. But we've discovered some things about running since then, and it's a lot easier now than it used to be. And I'd like to show you a few things about running. One of the things I do when I start a marathon now, you start off with all these thousands of runners, right? And there's all these people running around you. And the first couple miles are, you know, everyone runs together because no one has died yet. But you can look around you, and I've discovered that I can tell the first 100 yards of marathon, I can tell who's going to still be running with me at mile 20 and who isn't. Just by the way they run. So, for example, we're going to look at running form just a bit here. The red line down the center of this runner's body here shows his center of gravity. Our knowledge of physics tells us that any time when you run, the place where your foot strikes the ground, if that strike point is in front of your center of gravity, that is actually resisting the direction that you're trying to go. So when we run, obviously our goal is to move forward. And any time your foot is spending time in front of your center of gravity, it's actually working against what you're trying to do. All right, the ground it's actually breaking. And so one of the things you do when you run this way, when your foot is striking the ground in front of your center of gravity, it's kind of like driving your car and hitting the gas pedal for 2 seconds, then laying on the brakes for 2 seconds, and the gas pedal for 2 seconds, brake for 2 seconds, gas pedal, 2 seconds, brake. It's not a very efficient way to run. And if you do that for 26 miles, you will hurt. It's not an easy way to travel that distance. All right? And so whenever we start a marathon, these people are all running around you, right? And I watch the way they run, and I say, I don't got to worry about that guy. He's not going to be a problem later on. That guy there, he might beat me. I can tell he's a runner. I can tell he's not a fake. I can tell he actually is a runner because he's not doing this. So to run efficiently, what we want to do is we want to move our strike point, the place where our foot hits the ground. We want to move it back so that our foot is not hitting the ground in front of our center of gravity, but actually hits the ground first behind the center of gravity, or at least is close to the center of gravity so it spends the least amount of time in front of your center of gravity as possible. And you can tell, if you're not sure what you do, go look at your sneakers. If you do any running, go look at your sneakers that you run in. And I'm going to guess that most of you, if you look at the bottom of your shoe, would find that the heel of your shoe, the rubber, is really worn right there. Because you probably run by jamming your heel into the ground in front of the center of gravity. So you can go check out your sneakers afterwards if you want to find out how you run. Right? So what we want to do is we want to move that strike point back. Right? And literally what it does is it becomes effortless. Because all you do is you keep from falling over. That sounds dumb, I know. But that's all you do. You keep from falling over. So you lean forward and you actually relax all your muscles. You're like, they're relaxed. You're not pushing off with them. And so what you do is you just, instead to keep yourself from falling over, you're tipping forward and you put your foot down. Right? That's all. And it hits the ground behind your center of gravity. And before you fall over farther, you put your other foot down in front of that one, right? And so it's basically, if you want to know what it's like, you can test yourself. If you just stand here and go like this, lift your feet up and down, that's the kind of feel that you should have when you're running the right way. It just feels effortless. You're not using a lot of muscles. You're just keeping yourself from falling over. That's all. Right? And that's what this form does for us. So our goal is to move forward. Now, since our foot is spending time behind the center of gravity, it is actually working with us, not against us. All right? And my brother and I have discovered that is the only way to actually run a marathon without really, really, really hurting. And it's the only way to run really, really fast for that kind of distance. It's why whenever you hear of these Olympians that run that distance at incredible speeds, they run 5-minute miles for 26 miles, it's because they're not running like you run whenever they do that. They're relaxed. It's effortless. That's why they can run that fast for that long. Now, so what's that have to do with being a teacher, right? So if you're going to be a runner, all right, you have to find a way to actually do this efficiently. You can see the face. You can see the real runners from the ones that aren't the real runners right away. So in the classroom, apply it to the classroom, right? If you're a teacher, you have to find a way. You have to find a way to work in your classroom sustainably and efficiently, right? And one of the ways you can do that is actually, I already heard it this weekend, you have to know yourself and bring yourself to the classroom. One of the things I see teachers do a lot of times is, it's like, this is me, but me stays home and I work my head off on content, try to come to the classroom and present all this great stuff, and I never bring me along. And it's hard. When you do that, it is hard. So I would suggest bringing your hobbies with you to the classroom. But one of the things I've decided, I like to archery hunt. One of the things I've decided, if I'm going to teach school for 30 years, I have to find a way to teach school and archery hunt. And it's not that archery hunt is some god in my life, right? But it's what I enjoy doing. And so I'm going to find a way to actually make teaching and archery hunting work together, because that's what I like to do. That's how I can teach for 30 years. And I bring that into my classroom. I don't know if any of you are over there. There's a dirty pair of antlers in my room over there right now. Because me and some of my students were out walking around the woods and we found them. So I bring my hobbies with me to the classroom because I know that's the only way I can actually have fun teaching for 30 years. It's the only way it's really sustainable for me. You can't let yourself at home. This is also why it matters what kind of person you are. You can't just be anybody. It's why there are people that are teachers and there are people that aren't teachers. Because there are certain kinds of people that actually connect with young people better. There are certain kinds of people that actually have interests that draw young people out. There are certain kinds of people that have the kind of character that actually calls young people to another way of living. It's why it matters who you are and what kind of person you are. And if I can say this as humbly as I possibly can, take this as a humble word to maybe you older teachers. I went through high school here at FBCS. And we get if you're a student here, you get a barrage of different teachers because you have you get the apprentices and also all the teachers around here. And so you get all these different teachers. And one of the things I would say for you older teachers is that this is what happens. As you get older, you begin to lose some of those things you had as a younger person. The ability to go out and run with the young bucks is gone. Right? And that's okay. That's okay, but you do need to replace that with something. You still have to be someone in that classroom that actually draws those young people out. You can't become irrelevant. And so maybe the days are gone that you can go out and, you know, take on the young guys and get respect by beating them at their own game. Maybe that's gone. But you do need to find something else then that actually makes you the kind of person that attracts children and young people to you. That's what it means to be a teacher and why it matters what kind of person you are. You can't just be anybody and be a teacher. Second part to that is, who are you in your community? It struck me one day, it was after church, I was standing there, and all of a sudden it hit me, like, what am I doing? Sunday after church discussion, I had 15 young guys standing around me, and I was talking about sharks. I don't even know very much about sharks. And they were firing questions at me about sharks, and boy, I was loving it. I mean, I don't know that much about sharks, but we were having a good time after church discussion. It wasn't sports for once. And all of a sudden it struck me, you know what? I am a teacher in this community. I can't get away from it. It's not like it's just when I'm in that classroom. I can't even get, after church, I'm still doing it. Can't get away from it. That's who you are in the community. And I would suggest that that kind of being is far more sustainable than you can go out and just work and work and work and work and steady, 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 steady. And you got to do those things, right? Those things are important. But if you never be a teacher, I don't think you can make it very long. I put in your handout a little diagram. I'm not going to say much about it. Just real quickly, take a look at it. You maybe should look it up sometime on the internet if you get a chance. It's called TPAC. All right, it stands for Total Package. This is been developed very much in the secular world, all right? But sometimes people that are not Anabaptist have good ideas, sometimes, still. And this is one of them. TPAC is something that has become popular in probably the last 2 years. Some of you may already know about it. Maybe you've studied up on it already. But it connects to this thing of being, all right? So you got three circles. You got technology, you got content, and you got pedagogy, all right? And I think we as teachers, we often fall into this trap of really spending a lot of time in just one of those circles, right? And we're all different. It depends on what kind of person you are, right? Where we think it's all about the content, all right? And this is not a new idea to you all at all. This is not a new idea. Think it's all about the content, or sometimes it's all about the technology. And don't think YouTube videos when you think technology, right? Technology is however you present the content that you're presenting, right? If you might be the technology, right? It's how you decide this content needs to be presented to my students, right? Pedagogy is your expertise on how students learn. So you're the one that needs to decide. You know the case. So some students are, you know, what are visual learners, and so you understand students. You understand these things, and so you use your understanding, your wisdom of students to know how to be a better teacher. Right? That's pedagogy. Okay. So what we want to do in this model here is we want to spend our time in the middle where the three circles overlap. Right. And you become the kind of person that you shape the content with yourself. You shape the technology with yourself. You shape the pedagogy with yourself. Those things can't stand alone, right? And so we aren't going to do things all the same. I like chalkboards, right? I don't like PowerPoint. I feel uncomfortable using PowerPoint, and I'll probably use chalkboards till I quit teaching, unless they can't buy them anymore or something like that. So that's how I shape the technology that I use in my room. That's me. So what we want to do is we spend our time in the middle there. That's called the total package. Go study it up for yourself sometime and throw it in there as a resource. The third paradigm shift that I'd like to talk about is from on-off buttons to growing in wisdom. Some of you might have seen this. A few years ago, I saw on the news, there was this little video clip of, if any of you are from South Carolina, I'm sorry, not to be degrading at all, but Miss South Carolina. And she was answering this question, and I'd like to actually give the answer she gave to the question. I'd like to tell you the story here. She was in a beauty pageant, right? Which I don't know much about, but from one of the things I understand since then, that they do, which I find interesting, they actually do this in a beauty pageant, and that is that they actually have this bowl where one of the things all the contestants have to do is they pick a question out of that bowl, and you don't know what it's going to be, and then they have to try to answer the question, which is interesting. They do it at a beauty pageant, but anyway. So this is what Miss South Carolina was doing. She picked out this question, right? The question was, recent polls in America show that 1/5 of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a map. Why is this? This was her answer. I personally believe that the U.S., Americans, are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps. And I believe our education, like such as South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa and the Iraq and the Asian countries so we will be able to build up our future for our children. You can actually, I looked this thing up again, and you can actually, you can go watch this on YouTube still. The poor lady is never going to live that thing down because it's all over the place. And the comments underneath this video are just retarded. And most of the comments are about her being uneducated. And it struck me that, you know, that's not true. She's not uneducated. She's actually incredibly educated. She's just educated in a completely different field. She's educated in the use of I don't know, I'm trying to see if I can get this stuff, eyeshadow, mascara, am I saying that right? Whatever, all those things. She's actually incredibly educated in those things, right? That's why she was in the beauty pageant. And one of the things you need to understand is education is not something that you just turn on and off. It doesn't work that way. All you do is you decide, you get to guide what you're going to be educated in, right? And that's one of the beautiful things about being a teacher, is you actually get to be part of that guiding. So one of the things I think we often think is, okay, so our students are going to walk into the classroom in the morning and bloop, we're going to turn education on. And then it's interesting, for some reason there's this idea that then education turns off when they walk out of the classroom. It's not the way it works. We're constantly being educated. Just the other day, I walked out of the gym here, walked out into the back parking lot, and some young fellow asked me, "Are you learning a lot?" I said, "No, I'm not learning anything right now because I'm not in there." That actually wasn't true. Right at the moment, I was learning that, man, it was really hot out there. I was learning, man, this parking lot is really hot, and I'm getting ready to get in my car, and it's going to be hotter in there. And I was just learning something other than what was going on in here. You don't turn learning on and off. You just guide people to wisdom. That's what teachers do. And you need to understand that your students are learning all the time, not just when you're lecturing. Fourth paradigm shift. From school as an isolated institution to school as an extension of the community. I'll just be honest with you. One of the things that has troubled me and is very frustrating to me is the fact that we've been out of public schools for, what is it now, 50 years? And one of the things we're still doing is we're still trying to convince our parents and our communities that what we do is important and is valid. That tires me out. We're still trying to tell our parents as educators that it's important that your child goes beyond eighth grade. And they're still not convinced. I'd like to call us from moving from an isolated institution to something that is more connected to the community, extension of the community. And I think we as educators are responsible to bring a lot of humility to this. What if our parents are right and we're wrong? What if they're right that after eighth grade, what we are giving to their children isn't really worth their time? What if they're right? Maybe we need to get better at what we do. Maybe we need to be humble and reevaluate what we're up to. I overheard a parent say this one time, and at first I was like, you've got to be kidding me. He said, yeah, my son's not finishing school because after eighth grade, you just learn the same thing over and over and over again anyway. I was like, man, I really wished I could have set his son down in my 12th grade physics class right then and see if you just learn the same things over and over and over again. But on the other hand, what are we giving to those older students? I'm tired of trying to convince our communities that what we have to offer is actually worth their time. I'd like to see us actually, the conversation come together. I'd like to see us move beyond that. Here we are, 50 years after getting out of public school, and the greatest thing we can boast possibly is that we've gotten out of public school. And we still have this gulf between parents and educators. And I'd like to see us move to more of an extension of the community where the conversation is more involved with the community. And I think even we as educators are missing some of the best stuff because that gulf still exists. And we say we work for the community. And I think that's true. I think we honestly do that, and I think in many scenarios that's very true. But we have to be careful that that doesn't just become another educator's intellectual idea, that in reality, there's still a gulf between community and educators. And we have a tendency to do these kinds of things. Now, it's interesting to me, as a teacher, I always talk to my students about things like, you know, we need to be lovers of God. We need to be, you know, I love God. We do all this talk, right? I think it's Derrida that says, what do you love when you love your God? It's a pretty good question. And we can fall into this trap of having these intellectual ideas that in reality, they don't mean anything. Are we really an extension of the community? And we may need to be called to incredible humility as educators to actually get to that place. The last paradigm shift I have for you is from Satan's 1-2 punch to Matthew 6:33. If Satan can't snuff the kingdom out, if that doesn't work, that's his number one punch, right? Just crush it, bring opposition, kill it. If that doesn't work, then his number two punch is normalize the kingdom. I think that's an example of what's happening to the church in America. So we can't just snuff it out straight up. So what we do is we normalize it. And we water it down and it becomes lukewarm. That's Satan's 1-2 punch. Tries to normalize things. It's interesting to me that the countries that actually have an official church are also some of the most un-Christian countries in the world. I think England's church attendance is like 5%. You have to check that up. I didn't go do the research this morning, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. So Satan normalizes things. If he can't get us the first way, then he's going to make it normal, right? It's the back door. This is why, in my mind, I really don't care that much that the In God We Trust stays on the quarter. That's not the defining thing for me in my life. Because just putting a Christian label on something and making it normal and feel normal that our money has something godly on it, just putting that label on there does not guarantee that it's actually a Christian quarter. Or that the people that are using that quarter actually trust in God. Just making that normal isn't enough. And one of the things I believe is that our God is not really a normal God. Normal gods, Zeus gods, they carry lightning bolts around, and their subjects serve them. And if they're unhappy with you, they hold the rain off your fields. Our God's not normal. He doesn't carry lightning bolts around. He became a human being like us, and he washed his disciples' feet. That is not normal. That's not like Zeus gods. And we're called Christ's example. We're called to imitate that. That abnormality. One of my biggest concerns, I'd like to leave you with this, is that Christian education has become normal. That your communities just expect Christian education to happen. What would it be like? We're always looking for teachers. Board chairmen are always calling here looking for teachers. What would happen if your community actually someone said, hey, we can't find a teacher, you're going to have to homeschool this year. We've come to just expect, there will be a Christian school in my community some way or another. It'll happen. And I'm worried that Christian education might just become normal and we might take it for granted. I come back to this thing of I believe that we're in a crisis. I believe that the next 10 years we're either going to make it or we're not going to make it. Yay, we're out of public schools. We've arrived. Now we can just put it in a box and lock it and throw away the key. Getting out of public schools isn't enough. We can't just, it's normal now. We got schools, we don't have to send our children to public school, and that's all we care about. So I'd like to leave you with Christian education is not normal. And you aren't normal. And don't let anyone lull you into becoming normal. All right, now I'm not talking about, I know there's a lot of normality that needs to happen in your classroom. I'm not talking about that, all right? You're not normal, and don't let Satan lull you into believing that what you're doing is just normal, and you've now arrived, and we've now have our schools, and so it can just go on like this forever, just as it is. I've heard lots of times this weekend that teachers have to be learners. And I think the primary way that we guard against this 1-2 punch of Satan, this attempt to just make what we do normal and taken for granted, is that we seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Because inherently in seeking, you're admitting that you haven't arrived. If you're seeking, you obviously think there's more to be had somewhere. And one of the things I find interesting is it doesn't say, seek ye first the kingdom of God, then once you've got it, because you will before you die, once you've got that, then you know, make sure you really protect that thing. It doesn't say that. It seems to indicate you're going to be doing this all your life. You're supposed to, 10 days before you die, still be seeking the kingdom of God and all His righteousness, and everything will be given to you if you do that. So inherently, as seekers, we become people that are humble enough to say we haven't arrived. We can get better. There is ways to improve. We haven't hit some plane where if we can just hold this, we'll be good till eternity. And as seekers, we primarily have that humility. And so I call us, I leave you, so you go back to your classrooms, seek ye first the kingdom of God and all His righteousness, with all the humility that you have. And I think you won't have to worry about this 1-2 punch of Satan. And the interesting thing is, I think your students will also be affected by it, because you won't just be this. A lot of times when people start going off on their relationship with God, it's like, 15-year-olds, just, we've heard this so many times. If you're a person that is seeking the kingdom of God with everything you have, that's purpose. That's also passion. Purpose and passion come together in that kind of a place. So I leave you with that verse, Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle. What you said makes a lot of sense. You did it with passion and purpose. And I like the fact that you left me with an idea of an evening activity for next year. You know that thing about the egg and the slingshot? How many of you would like to see him demonstrate that? Raise your hand. All right, there we go. A very exciting time, I'm sure it would be. Well, he gave some tips for the marathon. Still puzzling over the center of gravity, how that affects me with my shape, but let us run with patience as teachers and as disciples, as learners. Thanks again. And as a teaching week committee, we appreciate your attendance.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.